And that brings me to my first serious observation. We live in interesting and rather alarming times, an era in which, for the first time in my lifetime, journalists are being arrested and many of them prosecuted in substantial numbers in Western countries. Well, at least one Western country, my own. The event that's had the greatest publicity, perhaps, back home over recent months is the arrest of a gentleman called David Miranda, the partner of a Guardian journalist, Glenn Greenwald, under terrorist powers, apparently on suspicion that he was assisting in the trafficking of state secrets for his journalist partner. The government spoke of information that would help terrorism. The Guardian called this a profound escalation of the attack on journalism, and it's certainly a very worrying thing to have happened. But I wonder really whether that is apt language for that single arrest of someone who's not a journalist, because one of the curious things about the Snowden affair is that journalism has actually remained largely unaffected by interference, largely. On the other hand, as Private Eye has pointed out, if one's looking for something that can truly be called an attack on journalism, perhaps these three parallel inquiries by the Metropolitan Police would qualify. In those inquiries, the total number of journalists arrested so far is alleged by Private Eye, admittedly, to have reached that number. I don't know whether that's right. It's very difficult to get information about this, but as far as I can make out, it's certainly more than 80. And these inquiries and the current Owen Bailey prosecution have swallowed up vast amounts of public money. These are the best figures I can get. They're nearly a year old. But those are the figures for the police inquiries, not the trial. Then we've got the Leveson inquiry. That swallowed up further vast resources. 9 months of oral hearings, hundreds of witnesses, over £5 million and $68.5 million Hong Kong of cost on that. Vast public resources devoted to these inquiries and investigations. And when governments devote that sort of money and that sort of effort to that sort of exercise, two questions seem to me to arise. They're familiar questions to any human rights lawyer: necessity and proportionality. Proportionality is key. Could the same objective have been achieved in a less intrusive way? Well, let's confine ourselves to the moment, to the criminal process. Many would say, back home, that what is going on is necessary to lance a boil. We've had a terrible sequence of events, unprecedented misbehaviour by journalists. That's the way lots of people do talk after the phone hacking inquiry and the scandals that are surrounding it. But that line of argument assumes the existence of the misconduct alleged, and I'm going to avoid that. But on the other hand, I don't take the view that it's always wrong in every circumstance to invoke the criminal law against a journalist just because they're a journalist. It must be the case that immunity is not total. Without taking a position, though, on the disputed issues in these cases, it is possible to be extremely alarmed by what's going on. I found it profoundly troubling to witness, to witness what's gone on in terms of these arrests. The reason I think that many of us who are troubled are so troubled is that we see journalism as having a special intrinsic value that doesn't depend on exactly what is being done in the name of journalism. We believe that it isn't and shouldn't generally be the business of the state to suppress or threaten journalistic endeavour. And we believe that in a free society, the use of the criminal law against journalists should be the absolutely last resort, only when the matter is really serious and there is absolutely no realistic alternative should it be contemplated. But there is the rub. There's the problem, I think. Was there, in the context that we have and have had in the UK, of what is suspected to be large-scale phone hacking by journalists of not only celebrities but others, was there a realistic alternative? I put the question at a general level. And I'll admit, and here's one of the things that may upset, that I've surprised myself by the conclusion that I have reached. That is, that the deployment of the criminal law in these cases was an understandable response to what appeared to be a pressing problem. And what has happened, I think, is this, that the criminal law has been deployed to fill in a vacuum left by the absence of a regulatory system. In other words, if you have journalists apparently committing serious wrongs against members of the public, and there is no regulator that is capable of doing something about it, then it's understandable that the state steps in and exploits the criminal law. And the situation we were in and remain in at the moment is that there was and is no effective regulatory oversight of journalists. We do have this organisation, the Information Commissioner's Office, which, strangely enough, is a statutory regulator that covers the press. Everything that is put out by the press these days, all media, is data, the subject of this regulatory scheme. But this guy doesn't want to regulate the press, quite rightly, I dare say, and he's probably, his setup is unsuited to the task. We have the Press Complaints Commission, but that's not a regulator. It's widely misunderstood, and it's often criticised for failing in its regulatory task. But the clue is in the name. It's a complaints commission. It deals pretty well, and has done over the years, with complaints about press behaviour, but it is not a regulator, and never was. What it demonstrated by its attempts to deal with the phone hacking scandal at newsgroup newspapers was that it was incapable of becoming a regulator. Notoriously, it pronounced that it could see and had seen no evidence of anything of that kind going on. But we now know that there was some of it. Quite how much, we don't know yet, but there was. So I say the fact that the press was in effect unregulated during this period left the authorities with relatively few options. Once the scandal or the Millie Dowler story came out in The Guardian saying that there had been phone hacking of her phone, then politically something had to be done. I'm sorry, I keep putting on to the next slide. That leads, I think, to an important conclusion, which is one that's gone largely unrecognised, that effective press regulation provides a buffer between the practice of journalism and the criminal law. If properly carried out, it can protect those who exercise their freedom of expression through journalism from the most extreme interferences, which should very rarely be suffered, namely criminal prosecution and potential imprisonment. But don't misunderstand me when I talk about regulation. What's most important is that regulation, if it has to be imposed in the particular context, should be independent of government. So a second conclusion that I'd offer you is that independent self-regulation of the press offers this further advantage. It provides a buffer between journalism and the state generally, and can thus enhance press freedom, paradoxically perhaps. Now, those observations all flow from the UK context and the experiences that I've just covered in brief. They may or may not be points that hold good in other contexts outside the United Kingdom. I've already confessed that I am not familiar with the context here. I know enough from reading the papers over the last few days that it's a very different one from the one that we have back home. So please tell me during the question and answer session whether I've got it completely wrong for you. Whether in the UK we will have effective press regulation such as could serve as a buffer against state interference is another question, and a complicated one, and it's got a long history. And this is the two-minute version, if that. Because our Prime Minister thought that legislation, as recommended by Lord Justice Leveson, was a step too far, we ended up with this, a royal charter decided upon by a group of politicians, recommended to the Queen and created by her. It's thought by some commentators to be too cumbersome and legalistic. This was a very upsetting headline for those of us who practice in this area. We thought we could do it. A key feature of it, though, is that it does not create or compel anyone to create or to join a regulatory system. All it does is set up the regulatory scheme for someone else to create a regulator to be approved by it. And the press have put up two fingers to it. They're the only ones who really would be likely to create a regulator to regulate them. They've decided not to do one in the form that the government would like. They've created their own organisation called IPSO, the Independent Press Standards Organisation, which stands a good chance, in my view, of being a pretty effective regulator, although it's been heavily criticised by some as being nothing more than PCC Mark II. So I think there will emerge in the UK from the current long-running impasse a regulator sponsored and paid for by the press, like the Press Complaints Commission, but which has wider-ranging powers and can be seen as a more effective press regulator than its predecessor, which, as I say, wasn't really a regulator at all. And that, I hope and believe, optimistically, will actually provide greater protection for freedom of expression than the absence of any regulator. Now, let's get back to Edward Snowden and The Guardian. On the face of it, that story could hardly be more different from phone hacking. We have a remarkable multinational problem story here. The leader of the free world has seemed bent on categorising Snowden as a traitor. Mr. Snowden flees abroad, making a brief stopover here for that reason, but ending up in the arms of Mr. Putin, hardly the world's most renowned proponent or advocate of freedom of expression, the man who runs the regime which imprisoned the Pussy Riot group until recently and held Greenpeace protesters for many weeks. A very curious set of facts. But oddly, the facts of that story do have three features in common with the phone hacking situation. First, we're concerned with spying on people through technical means. Secondly, we have what seems to be a failure of regulation or oversight by the people responsible for governance of spying activity. And thirdly, it all comes to light in newspaper revelations. The key differences, I think, for present purposes are that it's not journalists, in this instance, spying on people in pursuit of stories for publication about their private lives. It's the state spying on their own people in the interest, it is said, of protecting national security. Now, one would think that provided a great deal more justification for the spending of public money on looking into what exactly happened, whether it was justified, whether it was proportionate. But the statistics on this story are those. One arrest, David Miranda, no public inquiries so far, and no money spent, so far as one can detect, on investigating the merits or demerits of what Mr. Snowden has revealed. What conclusions should we draw? Well, it's relatively early days for this story, but my feelings at the moment are these. It is worrying that the government response in the United Kingdom, and to a large extent in the United States, has been so weak, almost non-existent. There is talk of some sort of inquiry being launched, but nothing's happened yet. And I don't know about you, but I find the notion of being spied on by my own government a lot more troubling than the risk of having my voicemails intercepted and some journalists listening to me telling my wife I'll be home on the 4:52. A lot more troubling because the government is supposed to be looking after my interests, supposed to be my representative. So why so many resources devoted to the investigation of phone hacking and so little so far to these allegations? Secondly, on the other hand, there is some comfort to be gained from the limits to government action, at least in the UK, against those making the revelations. Yes, Snowden is on the run and can't be got at, so the fact that nothing's been done against him is probably insignificant. He's not a UK citizen, It's for the US to do what it can, if it wants to. And yes, there's been the arrest of David Miranda, the journalist's partner, but nobody is even talking about or whispering about prosecuting The Guardian or anyone else in the United Kingdom for revealing what Mr. Snowden has said. The stories are out, even though governments would rather they were not, and have made it clear. And that, I think, is quite a healthy sign of a democracy and the independent judiciary that I think are essential guarantors of press freedom, at least in our context. I think our government, at least, daren't take action in relation to these publications for those reasons. Democracy helps because it governs the sort of legislation that you get. Fewer bad laws emerge in democracies. They're not perfect and they are variable, but fewer bad laws emerge from them than perhaps from other regimes. They also involve perhaps more effective holding to account of decision makers, such as a prime minister who would have to authorise action against newspapers for publishing things that are said not to be in the national interest. And independence is crucial in two ways, I think. First of all, if there's to be a regulatory system for journalism, as there will be, I'm sure, in our context, the independence of that system from government, from the state, is absolutely vital for obvious reasons. But secondly, independence in the judiciary is a fundamental guarantee that if things go past a regulatory system, or there isn't one, and go to court at the instigation of the state, there will be a fair trial. And those two things provide essential checks to protect freedom of expression, at least in the UK context. Constant vigilance is, of course, necessary to protect freedom of expression from unnecessary or even malign interference. But I would suggest, overall, it's not in such bad health today, freedom of expression, as some might suggest. And I hope that we'll have a vigorous debate about whether my suggestions about my own country's experience have any application at all to yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark. We'll open the discussion up to the floor. I'll just start, if I may, with a question about the broader international context, in as far as you can address it. London has sometimes been described as the libel capital of the world. There is a concern that with further legal and regulatory changes down the road, perhaps, that reputation will only be reinforced as the rich and the powerful resort to the London courts to defend their reputations, to exercise, as they see it, their right to privacy. Do you see that trend emerging? Is that a concern that we the media should worry about?
Well, I understand. I completely understand why. I understand why that reputation has got about. It's largely based, I think, on history, not ancient history, but history probably from the 80s, when the powerful were able to and did get pretty large awards of damages from juries. We've just had a new Defamation Act that came into force on the 1st of January, and it has rebalanced things in ways which I think reinforce trends which were already there, which reduce the attractions of London as a venue for libel actions. But there's no doubt that it still is a lot easier to bring and succeed in a libel action in London or in England than it is in a lot of other places. And the big contrast, of course, is between England and the United States, where it's practically impossible to bring an action to protect your reputation. You have to prove, if you're anyone in the public eye, that the publication was malicious. So it will always be the case, I think, for the foreseeable future, that American-based journalists and lawyers will view English libel law as failing the test of proper protection of freedom of expression. but there's not much we can do about that. That's true of most countries around the world, I think.
Thank you. If any questions from the floor, if you could just wait for the microphone, please, and introduce yourselves. I see one over here.
Thank you. My name is Chen. I work for Mandic Wire Asia. It's an FT trade publication. I have a slight different interpretation of the UK government's reaction, and I wonder, what do you think? I don't really agree that the British government showed they are different from the US by not persecuting The Guardian or the journalist. I think what they did was a rather calculated action. They arrested a Brazilian, a foreigner. People don't care too much in Britain. So not a strong enough action to enrage the British public or damage their image as a government that champions freedom of press. However, it is strong enough a warning to journalists personally. Look, there can be serious consequences for yourself.
Yeah, the line that's been taken by The Guardian, which may be right, we don't know, is that was a step designed to intimidate. That's one of the things that I think we should have an inquiry to investigate. It's one of the things that's been called for, an investigation to why that happened. And there may yet be legal action to challenge the arrest. But I think it's just impossible to tell at the moment whether that was so. The UK government is saying that the action was taken independently by the police and not directed by the Home Office. Now, I'm an agnostic on that. I really am. There's a follow-up.
A quick follow-up and then...
Very quick follow-up. Do you think had the arrested person be a British member of the British public, it would have been different? There would be a stronger, much stronger appeal calling from everywhere to launch an inquiry.
No, I don't. I don't. I'm afraid I think that the British public, if that's the question, the British public don't care very much about this issue at the moment. Quite wrongly, but they really don't. They wouldn't be very exercised by the arrest of another journalist, number 121.
Over there, please.
So Robin Fox, I'm an associate. You glossed over a little bit the contents of the framework for the regulatory system. Can I ask you what actions took place which were complained about by members of HackDoff, which were not illegal at the time? Were there any at all?
Sorry.
Were there any issues which formed the basis of the complaint about the press that were not actually legal? Phone hacking certainly is, but what else?
I can't answer that. They may have all been illegal, that's true.
So isn't it a question of enforcing the existing regulatory framework rather than putting a political body in charge of press regulation?
No, I don't think it is, because I don't think there is an existing regulatory framework. I mean, what my point is that if you've got an effective regulator, let's say a professional regulator in the medical profession or the legal profession, that takes steps to investigate and oversee the way that the business is conducted and ensure that it's done properly and takes steps to sanction people when it's not, then the criminal law doesn't need to step in because it's not proportionate. And you can take different views about how serious this kind of behaviour really is. I do believe that in a properly regulated system, which we may have, it would have been sufficient possibly to stop some of this behaviour in the first place, to have a regulator, and if it happened, to take regulatory action, which might have included fines.
Tara?
Thanks for that thought-provoking speech. I'm Tara Joseph with Reuters. When you were talking about an independent regulator, I was trying to envision who these people would be, what types of people they would be. If you have a medical regulator, it's probably people with some knowledge of medicine, and there is a set of certification or a sense of what is done in medicine. In the legal regulation, you have laws, but we don't really have a set of laws. We might have a self-sense of principles in journalism. So who would these guys be?
Well, there are two models which are broadly similar. One is the Royal Charter model, and the other is the IPSO model. The differences between them are marginal because they both involve journalists in the system, people with experience.
Uh-oh. I can imagine journalists regulating journalists.
Well, but they are in the minority. There are different levels of this. One element of it is setting the code of conduct. There's a lot of fuss about this, but in the end, if you think about it, the elements of any code of journalism are well known, and if you look at codes around the world, they're all pretty similar. Try not to get it wrong. If you do, get it right, or apologise if it's serious enough. Don't publish things about people's private lives that don't have a public interest justification. That sort of list of things is not difficult. So getting journalists involved in devising the code, I think, is quite important. But I don't think it's a very significant causal thing, because the code will end up pretty much the same whoever does it. Everyone agrees, I think, that journalists should be involved, or could be involved, in an independent regulator. The question is whether they dominate it. And so the preferred model, I think, is the government's preferred model, is you have more people who are not journalists than journalists. And that is a model which, in fact, is more independent than the Bar Standards Board, which regulates me. They have lay people and they have lawyers, and it doesn't seem to me to be an intrinsically impossible model.
Anna?
Anna Fenton, hack, for want of a better word. Many of my former colleagues are languishing at home. These are Sun and News International employees at the moment, on full pay granted, but unable even to phone their colleagues because they think all their phones are tapped. Now, they're all charged under this thing, under this Leveson action. Two questions really out of this. Since most of the bribees have already pleaded guilty, these guys would seem to be on a hiding to nothing before they start. And where will this all end? Because once they're found guilty, I assure there will be appeals and it will go on and on and on. And as you say, there are scores of these folks. But the other thing is, whatever way you cut it, none of this was done in a vacuum, and the big bosses all signed off on all these dreadful deeds. So why is it that it's not News International in the dock? Why is it all the hacks?
Well, where will it all end? I fear you're right. Not that they'll all be convicted just because some have pleaded guilty, but it will continue, it'll take a long time, and there may be appeals. That's one of the reasons that I'm advocating a regulatory system instead of the use of the criminal law. I believe, perhaps naively, that it could be swifter and cheaper and less oppressive, which is how I see the current setup. As far as the question of the more senior people and their fate is concerned, there are people who believe that News International has shot itself in the foot collectively by being so open with information about what went on. Because once, in legal theory anyway, once you get people convicted who are at senior decision-making levels, you've got the company in frame for a further prosecution. Whether you go beyond that to people on the board would depend on whether they were personally involved. But I don't rule out, if some of the editorial people are convicted, a further prosecution involving the company. Yeah.
Is there a prospect, do you think, through regulatory means or otherwise, of creating some sort of perhaps delicate balance between the attitude towards reporting on politicians and celebrities and the prurient interest taken by the public in Britain, it would seem, in the personal lives of those people in comparison with, for example, France. Do you think some form of education of the British readership would take place through a regulatory process?
Well, that's a very interesting question, isn't it? I was told by the judge who does most of these cases the other day that almost all the cases that come to court are not media cases now. In other words, there was a great boom in cases about people's private lives being interfered with by the media. That's over. And so that may indicate that the press have already been educated by the judgments of the court. And I think there's quite a lot in that. It's not where it was in France, where private lives were sacrosanct until Monsieur Hollande got on his scooter. I think things are equalising across the channel. They're becoming more prurient while we become less open about it, I think, probably continuing to be prurient without putting it on the front page.
I just want to follow up on that last point. Is the example of France, you know, chills a lot of journalists who read in the UK with the extent to which the pendulum there protects the right to privacy. Is there any country, do you think, that does have a regulatory system that does strike the right balance for which Britain could take heed from?
No. You look around, and this is one of the reasons I did my cultural relativism point, because it does all depend. It depends very much on cultural attitudes, I think, because one of the curious things about the States is that although they have the most robust freedom of expression laws, and therefore the greatest freedom for the media to do naughty things, they don't, to anything like the degree that people do in the UK with our harsh libel laws. And it's similar in France. The laws actually are rather feeble in terms of the penalties that are imposed on journalists in France if they get it wrong. But they do toe the line, or have done for a long time. So there are wide variations across the world.
Francis?
Francis Moriarty, FCC. You, just as a passing observation, Hong Kong has on the books some of the stiffest criminal libel laws any place in Asia. In fact, I think there's only three places in all of Asia that still have criminal libel. My question goes to the question of data privacy. We have in Hong Kong a commissioner of privacy who takes a very robust line on linking numbers with information. And I think many of us feel that the data privacy issue is one that intrudes increasingly on press freedom. So I'm interested in how that is working in the UK, where you have, as you mentioned, a data privacy
regime. It's not good. We have a Europe-wide data protection regime which is about to be revamped and become harsher than it was, and the current regime has relatively limited protection for journalism, and it's going to get worse. We're having an uneasy time with data protection because it's running in parallel with privacy law in other fields. And but once people really get to grips with what our data privacy laws say across Europe, there's going to be some difficulty, because they are, I think, unduly harsh. They basically start with any information that's personal to an individual being protected unless you can show a reason for publishing it, which seems to me to be the wrong way around.
Gentleman on the veranda.
I'm Rob Thibault, barrister. I acted for Edward Snowden when he was in Hong Kong. I have a question about this regulatory regime. I mean, the risk of putting something that like that into place would be the chilling effect on journalism itself, whereas the just leaving the system as it is, with the journalists possibly facing criminal prosecution, there's no chilling effect on the journalism itself. There's just the threat that if a journalist misbehaves, breaks the law, like any other criminal, that you're going to be held to justice. But with the regulatory regime you're a proponent for, that may have a chilling effect right across journalism in the UK.
Well, yeah. I think the chilling effect argument has to be used with discretion, and it really all depends on what the content is and the way in which it's enforced. You say, well, leave criminals to be prosecuted when they commit criminal acts. In the UK, we have the Data Protection Act, which has a criminal offence in it, which is committed by anyone who deals with someone else's personal data or the data of a data controller without their consent. It has a public interest defence, but there'd be plenty of opportunities for prosecution under that section, especially since it's due to have a 2-year prison sentence attached to it as a result of Lord Justice Leveson's recommendations. So I'd be concerned that a government unfriendly to the press could exploit the criminal law in ways which would be buffered by a regulatory system.
I mean, the way I see this is it's just a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, the journalists who committed these offences with the phone tapping, they're educated. They should know better. They shouldn't have done that. And if the bosses were involved and companies were involved, it's just like anyone else in society. If you break the law, you can be prosecuted. But you know, to have a regulatory regime, you know, another layer of regulation, doesn't make sense to me. I think that if there's a problem with journalists, that they lack the professional personal integrity, then it's going to be universities, fellow journalists, who are going to have to increase their.
Well, but that's that. I see your point, but we can disagree about this. But part of the regime that's proposed and is actually coming into force will be to keep watch on the journalistic standards and practices. So there's an educational aspect to it. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think we just have to agree to disagree.
Wouldn't that be an ombudsman?
Well, I think that's what we're talking about, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about an organisation that will have independence. It'll have journalistic people on it. It'll be very similar to the existing regime that we've got, except it will have additional powers.
Interesting argument, but I tend to disagree. I think journalists will do fine if more education is required. I think this phone tapping incident caught everybody out. And I think to bring in more legislation and this layer of regulation is typically what governments do. They say, oh, there's been some bad journalists, let's regulate.
Oh, but it's important to understand this isn't what's going to happen, if I'm right, is not a result of legislation. It's a voluntary press-organised regime. There's no statute involved.
I think we have time for just one very quick last question, if anyone wants to amplify on any point. Gentleman here.
Does a citizen have any recourse against a public authority that maliciously prosecutes him? By coercion from big business interests or otherwise?
There is an action for malicious prosecution that you can bring against a prosecutor, yeah. And that's a legal, recognised legal cause of action. Of course, your question raises the issue of proof, and there's no tackling that, really, is there? I mean, that would depend on the individual case. But I'm not quite sure what you're envisaging, that maybe something more particular to this environment than the one I'm familiar with.
Thank you, Mark. I think on that note, we'll have to wrap it up now. Thank you very much for everyone's contributions. Thank you very much, Mark, for a stimulating discussion. We don't like our guests to leave empty-handed, well-fed, but also with a present in hand. So I'll just thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your time in Hong Kong.